Mr. Lazenby, reel 9.
Were these called iron rations?
No, I don't think that name was invented then. I think that was an army term, wasn't it, for the rations they used to take with them? I don't know.
Was it always, in times of scarcity aboard ship, was the alternative to fresh meat always bully beef, or was
Yes, there's nothing else.
No salted meat?
Well, we had salt pork, but I only remember having it once.
What was that like?
It was awful stuff. It was very tough and very salty, but you had to soak it for about a day before you could use it. And it was very hard, very tough.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The other parts of your rations, as it were, we haven't talked about, is the rum issue.
Mm.
Tell me about the rum issue. How was it issued, at what time, and what was the sort of general scene?
The rum issue was issued once a day at noon, and only those over 20 were allowed to draw rum. And they drew a third of a pint, mixed with two-thirds of a pint of water. See? It was 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And you got... I only got a half a pint, that's all. Sorry, not a pint, half a pint, but it was 2-1. A third of a pint of rum to two-thirds of a pint of water. That's how it was mixed up. Except petty officers and above, and they got it neat. Top neat.
Yes. Now, when the time of the day arrived to muster for rum, what was the scene? How was it handed
out? First of all, you had the officer of the day there who saw to the rum issue. He had to be there. You also had the master at arms, and you had one of the paymasters, petty officers, someone like that, a writer, who kept a tally and checked it all off, see that everyone got the rum. Now, the cook from each mess would line up with his fanny, they call it, which is almost like a paint can, but highly polished. And he would line up at the appropriate time at the rum barrel, which had great big brass rings around it, and God Save the Queen on it, and God Save the King, appropriately, see. The master downs would be there to see that it was mixed properly with the proper amount of water, proper amount of rum, and then it would be dished out. You'd line up number 16 mess, and you'd say so many, and you'd get so many tots of rum. You'd go down to the mess...
How were the tots measured?
They were measured with these great copper measures, you know, right from a half a gill up to about a gallon. They had a whole series of them, beautifully polished in copper. I don't really remember, like a big jug. You ever seen them? And they were measured. They dipped them in the rum and measured them out into your fanny. And for instance, if you had, say, a gallon less half a gill, they'd put a gallon in, then take half a gill out, sort of thing. And they measure it out that way. But the petty officers got it neat.
So the rum was collected by the cook of the day?
Yes.
Then what?
Taken down to the mess, and the leading senior of the mess was responsible for dishing it out to everyone. They all lined up there and on the spot to get the tot. And if there was anything left in the rum barrel when it finished, it was emptied down the scuppers. It wasn't kept, because two water wouldn't keep anyhow. You couldn't bottle it.
Now, if there were a number of men in the mess who didn't drink, what would happen to their tot?
You didn't draw it. I never drew my tot. Instead of which, I got a guinea a quarter in lieu. Threepence a day. You know, threepence a day for your rum. And if you didn't draw your rum, you got the threepence a day, which was a guinea a quarter.
Was there any drawing of rum by non-drinkers and passing it on to the other members of the mess?
Oh, yes.
Under what sort of circumstances?
But not so much among the seamen as the petty officers. You see, the seamen couldn't bottle their rum. It wouldn't keep. And you could get almost anything done for a tot of rum. If you wanted to go ashore and you were watch aboard and you couldn't go, you could get a substitute to go for you. And you could always get a substitute for a tot of rum. Anything you wanted to do, and a tot of rum would be a good payment for it. But the petty officers used to bottle theirs. They weren't allowed to, but they did. And they could bottle neat rum and save it up and have a good blue almost every while, you know. And they could get almost anything done for a tot of neat rum.
Were there any special occasions, like perhaps birthdays, when you might give a member of the mess a bit more than his share?
Oh, yes, we'd splice the main brace. For instance, if we'd won regatta, the captain might say, it'd be very generous, we'll splice the main brace. And everybody got an additional tot. Well, if you had royalty aboard or anything like that, you'd get an extra tot of rum, and that was called splicing the main brace, which is very, very seldom in here.
Now, aboard the Emperor of India, when you were doing boys' duties, what did they involve?
You're under strict surveillance all the time. The boys never mixed with the men. They had their own messes, their own instructors. You were doing instruction most of the day, but you also had other duties which only a boy could do, mostly messengers, officers' messengers, bridge messengers, gangway messengers. You might have been a call boy, because in those days they didn't have the loudspeaker systems. And if you had to make a call, you went virtually all around the ship blowing your whistle and piping these different instructions, you see. A bugler would help, of course. So he's either a call boy or a side boy. Now, you'd be on the gangway then, and you'd attend to all boats coming alongside and look after the cleanliness of the accommodation ladder. But there are all sorts of little duties like that that boys did.
As far as the proportion of your time which was allocated to various kinds of training, was it more or less a continuation of the training you'd already had, or were you specialising at this stage?
Well, we were specialising because after you'd done your basic training, there were other things about the ship that you had to know. I mean, there are things that are peculiar to a ship, where things are stowed and what they're for and what they do and how to do them, that you can never learn from books. But then you were given an opportunity to do electrical work or gunnery work or signals or whatever you'd like to specialise in. Now, I wanted to do electrical work, and so I joined the torpedo staff, as you know, they trained me, and I qualified as an acting seaman torpedoman, which meant that I helped with whole lighting circuits and changing bulbs and that sort of thing. Wasn't watching it, but learning a bit about it, you see.
How generally were the boys treated by the men?
Oh, very well. They didn't have a lot of dealings with them, you know. They were kept pretty well segregated as boys.
Why was that?
Well, I think homosexuality had a lot to do with it.
Was there much of an incidence of that?
There were some of it, yes. A lot of it was kept undercover, of course, but when it did come to light, it was a very, very serious thing altogether.
Was there any pattern to it?
Usually you'd find an older seaman would take a boy on as what they called a winger. Take him under his wing. In many cases, of course, it was all genuine and aboveboard, and the older seaman took a genuine interest in the boy and would teach him all he knew, all the finer parts of his trade, all the intricate knot making and splicing and things like that. But sometimes it may have been a more homosexual relationship. But, of course, it was kept undercover. If it came to light, there were very, very serious consequences.
When you say kept undercover, you mean there were some special cautions given you so that this kind of information never reached the ears of the public?
It never reached you. We always used to say it was all man and winger, you see. In all probability, there was a legitimate interest between the two, and they were great friends, and it went no further. But we always had in the back of our minds that there was something going on that shouldn't be, or an older man wouldn't have associated with a younger boy. Mm.
Were there any branches where it seemed to be more prevalent than others?
No, I don't think so. It was on the... there was homosexuality. Don't run away with the idea that I'm making that there wasn't. But it was very, very difficult to prove it. Because if it could be proved, the guilty ones would be discharged from the service with shame, with ignominy. The corners of the service certificates torn off.
That was the sole punishment for offences?
Usually, yes. They were dismissed from the service. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've mentioned these various branches that you had the opportunity to specialise in and what you chose. What were the relations like between the various branches? Was there any kind of sort of hierarchy?
I suppose there was a bit, but not much. I don't think the gunnery people always thought themselves the cream of the Navy. They were always very strict. They had a very high esprit de corps among the gunnery people. They went to Whale Island, which was a purgatory of a place as far as I know, and every gunnery man was smart, you know, and they knew them. Yes, I think they would consider themselves the elite gunnery people.
Who were the non-elite, as it were?
Well, the torpedomen were the brainy ones. The gunnery people were all, what shall I put it, you know, all brawn. But the torpedomen were the brains. I mean, they had to learn electrical circuits, and they had to do schooling and things like that. So.
Were there any of the branches which were regarded as, you know, the other end of the scale from the cream?
Stokers, especially the junior stokers, what they call in the merchant service greasers, they would be, I think. Although later on, of course, they got to be mechanically minded. I mean, there had a lot of stuff that we knew nothing about. Mm.
At the time we're talking about now, were there any grounds for regarding the stokers as, you know, the sort of thickies of the service?
The stokers, yes, because they were always dirty. On a coal ship, they're always dirty. And it was hard work down the stoke holes. And they wore greasy old clothes with a bit of old rag round the neck. Mm.
Were there ever any forms of sort of rivalry or competition between the branches that you can recall?
Oh, there was always rivalry, and if there was ever any opportunity to compete one against the other, they did. And they messed separately. The torpedomen messed in their own mess. The stokers messed in their own mess. The gunnery people were mixed up, but they were all seamen, you see. But the torpedomen were separate, and the stokers were separate.
I imagine aboard ship you must have found that the pattern of life in the mess was very different from mess life at Ganges and in Greenwich, where you tended not to use the messes too much, whereas aboard ship, all of your off-duty time must have in the main have been spent in them.
Most of it, yes.
Yeah. Mm. Now, what kind of things would you do? What was the sort of pattern of mess life?
Well, mess life, it was your home. You only had a table and two stools and a kit locker with all your kit in it. It was very usually adjacent to the mess. Your ditty box was kept in a rack overhead, and so was your cap box. And that's all you had. And so you did all your writing there, you did all your reading, you did all your playing. I mean, if you wanted to play cards, you played in the mess. If you wanted to do a bit of ironing, although ironing, of course, was a later thing. At that time, when I'm talking about, we had a roller and a bat. You used to put your clothes in it and roll it on the bat. And you did practically everything you did in the mess. And you playing a musical instrument, or things like that. And you didn't get on each other's nerves, somehow. The wife could never understand why I can sit and write a letter when the radio's on. And I said, I can ship that out and I'll listen to it. Mm.
Was there much of an incidence of... Oh, we're nearly finished. Yeah. Change the reel.